Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the November 28th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The agonizing presidential election season ended 3 weeks ago, and now we are confronted with daily reports about the potential economic crisis, what we are told is a fiscal cliff. If President Obama and the Democrats are unable to come to an agreement by January 1st about how to reduce the country's massive war-produced deficit and increase the Treasury's revenues. There have been a number of none too subtle hints that some of the nation's premier people-oriented programs, such as Medicare, Medicaid, and even Social Security, which is self-funding and not dependent on general tax money, will be on the chopping block. How far Obama is willing to surrender of the latter has been subject to speculation for months, but if what he has done in his first 4 years in office is a sign of what's to come, news out of Washington will not be good. Today to talk with me about that, about 20 minutes past the hour, will be Salon.com's Matt Stoller, an experienced vet of the political wars while working for the Democratic Party, whose article of October 27th entitled "The Progressive Case Against Obama" may come to be seen as the most damning indictment of the president's first 4 years of office. And we'll be talking about his domestic policies, not what he and those under his command have done abroad. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's take a fresh look at some history and other related news. Tomorrow, November 29th, will mark the 65th anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly's approval of a resolution that would have partitioned Palestine with its overwhelmingly Arab population into a Jewish state and a Palestinian state, with the Jews, who made up 33% of the territory's total population in 1947 and owned but 6% of the land, receiving 56% of it under the UN-approved arrangement, while the more numerous Palestinian Arabs would be reduced to 43% and Jerusalem would become an international city. Thanks to some heavy threats and arm twisting by Israel's friends in the United States, the resolution passed by a 33-13 vote. The Arab High Committee representing the Palestinians refused to accept what was a prima facie injustice, while the Jewish delegation led by Chaim Weizmann, the longtime Zionist leader, jumped at the opportunity, and 6 months later, on May 15, 1948, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion declared the State of Israel into being. This led to an invasion of the area allotted to the Palestinians by five Arab armies, over which the new state prevailed, thanks to warplanes illegally smuggled across the Atlantic by American Jewish World War II vets, plus key shipments of infantry weapons provided by Czechoslovakia after a brief suspension in the fighting. It also resulted in the ethnic cleansing of a term that had not yet existed, of more than 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and villages, over 500 of which were quickly destroyed by the victors to make sure those who had lived in them would never return. Israel also added to its territory more land than was allotted to it by the UN vote, yet to this day it has never sought to establish its eastern border, leaving many to speculate that it plans to annex much of the West Bank as it did Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, regardless of what the rest of the world may think about it. Writing later about the circumstances surrounding that first UN vote, President Harry Truman would note, quote, "The facts were that not only were there pressure movements around the United Nations unlike anything that had been seen there before, but that the White House, too, was subjected to a constant barrage. I do not think I have ever had as much pressure and propaganda aimed at the White House as I did in this instance," wrote Truman. "The persistence of a few of the extreme Zionist leaders, actuated by political motives and engaging in political threats, disturbed and annoyed me," end quote, Harry Truman. And it should be noted, it has disturbed and annoyed every American president since. Well, tomorrow, to celebrate that anniversary, if things go as planned, the overly lame duck president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, will go before the General Assembly of the UN in New York and ask for it to approve non-member status for the state of Palestine, and by doing so, to restore his much tarnished reputation among the Palestinian people. While a majority vote is all but certain, Israel and the United States seem to be alone in arguing that it is a, quote, unilateral move, and that statehood could only come through direct Israeli-Palestinian talks, in which Israel would not only be the dealer, but would hold all the cards. Moreover, the Israeli Knesset West, sometimes known as the U.S. Congress, has threatened to cut off funding to the Palestinian Authority and to any U.N. agency the Palestinians might join as a result of the U.N. upgrade. We've obviously been very clear that we do not think that this step is going to bring the Palestinian people any closer to a state, that we think it is a mistake, that we oppose it, that we will oppose it, said U.S. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland on Monday. Nuland, by a funny coincidence, happens to be the wife of Robert Kagan, a leading pro-Israel neocon. The position on the subject on the part of three key U.S. allies, Britain, France, and Australia, ranges from ambiguous to outright support for the Palestinian position. The U.K. Foreign Minister William Hague attempted over the weekend, unsuccessfully, to make the Palestinians accept three conditions. One, that they would resume peace talks without preconditions. Two, that they would not ask for UN membership formally. And three, that the Palestinians would not apply to join the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice. Israel is not a party to the ICC treaty, so its rules would not apply within the boundaries of Israel, such as they are. But if a Palestinian state were able to join the ICC, actions of the Israeli occupation force in the West Bank and the Israel Defense Force within Gaza could be referred to the International Criminal Court. France announced yesterday that it plans to vote in favor of recognizing a Palestinian state, becoming the first major European country to do so, dealing what is seen as a setback to Israel. Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius told Parliament that France has long supported Palestinian ambitions for statehood and, quote, will respond yes when the issue comes up for a vote out of a concern for coherency, end quote. Europe is divided over the issue. Switzerland and Portugal have said they will vote for the measure, but Germany is among the countries that have opposed the bid. Australia's Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, relied on her governing authority when she decided on Monday that Australia would vote in support of Israel and against Palestine, but her overruling the advice of her Foreign Affairs Minister, Bob Carr, and the overwhelming opinion of her cabinet opposing her position set off a firestorm. After being advised that she was about to face a full Labour Party caucus revolt on the matter yesterday, Gillard capitulated, and in tomorrow's vote, Australia will abstain. Only seven countries are expected to oppose the move to upgrade Palestinian recognition: Israel, the United States, Canada, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. Some collection, huh? Well, in the 64 years of its existence, Israel has become a world leader in the high-tech field and scientific achievements while producing an economy whose differences in income distribution are among the widest in the world, matching those of the United States. Toward the indigenous Palestinian population, however, it ethnically cleansed in 1948, and to its Lebanese neighbors to its north, whose land they have invaded three times, the policies of Israel's leadership and the actions of its armed forces have been characterized by an unmatched use of collective punishment and what can be described as nothing less than unbridled, virtually unmitigated sadism from its top brass down to its lowest military ranks. This sadism is something I personally witnessed in occupied Palestine and in Lebanon over a 40-year period, and it has been attested to not only by Palestinian and Lebanese who have been its victims and a handful of courageous Israeli journalists who have reported on it, but by former members of Israel's military itself. That sadism is once again on full display throughout Israel's latest aerial and seaborne assault on Gaza, one of the world's most densely populated territories, whose borders, waters, and airspace Israel controls, and which it pretends to the world that it no longer occupies. And as always, when it launches a war on a largely defenseless target, as it did again this month, it portrays itself and the Israeli people as the quote-unquote victims, with a well-founded confidence that whoever happens to be nominally in charge of the White House, as well as both the Senate and House, which its U.S. lobby tightly controls, will repeat their lies as if they were their own. Hence, we had President Obama, despite the fact that Israel's latest attack on Gaza pushed his long-planned Asian trip off the front pages, calling Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on the phone and publicly expressing his support for the Israeli people and Israel's right of, quote-unquote, self-defense. The right to self-defense is something the president has consistently denied the Palestinians, who are the ones being disproportionately killed and maimed, and whose homes and businesses have been destroyed this November as they were in December 2008 and January 2009. as Obama was about to begin his first term. Israel's U.S. ambassador, the American-born turncoat Michael Oren, spoke during a visit to Capitol Hill in mid-November after both houses of Congress overwhelmingly voted for resolutions in support of Israel's inherent right to act in self-defense. The United States, said Oren, has given us the full backing to take whatever measures are necessary to defend our citizens from Hamas terror. Israel has received unequivocal and outstanding support from the United States and all branches of government, from the White House, from Congress, and both parties, completely bipartisan support, end quote. And there could be no arguing with that. Not only has the Obama administration, as had Bush and Clinton before him, made sure that Israel received America's top F-16 fighter jets and Apache attack helicopters free of charge, and the killer missiles and rockets to go with them, but Obama went even further and saw to it that Israel was provided with $200 million extra for the Iron Dome, a weapon that acted as a defensive shield and knocked down 88% of the puny locally made rockets that the Palestinians in Gaza fired off in their defense. There have been some liberal pundits following the elections who have written that Obama's victory was a sign that the Israel lobby was losing its clout in Washington. But that notion was quickly put to rest when both houses of the U.S. Congress unanimously passed resolutions by voice vote expressing support for Israel's quote-unquote inherent right to act in self-defense, unquote. Initiated in the Senate by Senators Kirsten Gillibrand, New York Democrat, and Mark Kirk, Republican, Illinois, the two parties come arm in arm on that, and in the House by Representatives Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, Republican of Florida, and Howard Berman, Democrat of California, who was defeated by another pro-Israel Democrat, Brad Sherman, in November. Each resolution, quote, expresses unwavering commitment to the security of the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state with secure borders and recognizes and strongly supports its inherent right to act in self-defense to protect its citizens against acts of terrorism, end quote. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, which no doubt drafted the resolutions, issued a statement praising, quote, the leadership of Senators Gillibrand and Kirk and the extraordinary show of support by the Senate for Israel's struggle against terrorist attacks on its citizens, end quote. The Senate resolution garnered 66 co-sponsors, all of whose names were available at AIPAC's website, as well as a list of those who did not co-sponsor. Dianne Feinstein was among the former, while Barbara Boxer was not. Unlike statements of support for Israel's actions from the Obama administration, the resolutions did not call to exercise restraint, for Israel to exercise restraint or express any regret at the casualties on the Palestinian side, which were 160 compared to Israel's 5. Calling for a voice vote, the heads of both the House and Senate, Republican and Democrats, arm in arm, lockstep, made sure that not even the handful of members of Congress who would have voted against the resolution or abstained, such as Ron Paul, Keith Ellison, and Dennis Kucinich, would be allowed to do so. Paul himself attested to this when he tellingly said on YouTube available on the internet, quote, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton traveled to Tel Aviv to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, but she refused to meet with the elected Palestinian leaders, referring to Hamas. Clinton said upon arrival in Israel, Paul went on, America's commitment to Israel's security is rock solid and unwavering, end quote. Does this sound like an honest broker, asked Paul? At the same time, he continued, Congress acted with similar ignobility when an unannounced resolution was brought to the House floor after the business of the week had been finished, and in less than 30 seconds, Paul said, the resolution was passed by unanimous consent without debate and without most representatives even having heard of it. The resolution H. Res. 813 was so one-sided, it is not surprising they didn't want anyone to have the chance to read and vote on it. Surely at least a handful of my colleagues would have objected to language like, quote, the House of Representatives expresses unwavering commitment to security of the state of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state with secure borders, end quote. U.S. foreign policy being so one-sided actually results in more loss of life and in security on both sides, said Paul. Surely Israelis do not enjoy the threats of missiles from Gaza, nor do the Palestinians enjoy their Israeli-imposed humane conditions in Gaza. As long as Israel can count on its destructive policies being underwritten by the U.S. taxpayer, said Paul, it can continue to engage in reckless behavior. And as long as the Palestinians feel the one-sided U.S. policy lined up against them, they will continue to resort to more and more deadly and desperate measures. Continuing to rain down missiles on so many increasingly resentful nations, the U.S. is undermining rather than furthering its security. Paul goes on, we are on a collision course with much of the rest of the world if we do not right our foreign policy. Ending intervention in the Middle East, interventionism in the Middle East, and replacing it with friendship and even-handedness would be a welcome first step, end quote. That's Ron Paul, but who in Washington is listening? Certainly not the President or Congress.